Take your two favorite words, smush them up together, and you got yourself a portmanteau. Join us on the latest You're Saying It Wrong podcast as we look at how we mash up words to turn them into other words. Humpty Dumpty would be so proud. You're Saying It Wrong. Find it at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental or additional
to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
There is a blurb from Matt Johnson on the back of the novel How I Learned to Hate in Ohio that reads, David Stuart McLean is a writer who can break your heart, terrify you, and make you laugh, all on the same page. I'm typically not a blurb reader, but this was such a good description of McLean's writing that I just had to include it. How I Learned to Hate in Ohio is a coming-of-age story set in the mid to late 80s in central Ohio. It takes a hard look at the high school hierarchy of power, insular ignorance, and fear of the other. And we have Gatsby along for the ride. I recently spoke with David Stuart McLean about his novel, How I Learned to Hate in Ohio. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. So, we should set up the book. How I Learned to Hate in Ohio takes place over the course of 6 years, from August 1985 to June 1991. It's set in a fictional town in central Ohio, and we see this time and place through the lens of a boy who is 14 years old and starting high school when this begins. And there are so many directions we can take this description from here. We can touch on the bullying, the Islamophobia, the homophobia, and the racism, and I think we'll cover most of that in this conversation. So instead, I want to say that Barry is a reader. Can you talk to me about The Great Gatsby and not only Barry's experience in reading and rereading it, but also how this story was influenced by it?
Yeah. So Barry hates The Great Gatsby. and I think a lot of 14-year-olds do. And I think it's because they get sold a bill of goods. Like the way I was taught The Great Gatsby was I was taught it through its symbols, and I was told that it was a love story. And I think those are two of the least interesting ways to look at The Great Gatsby. I think The Great Gatsby is amazing because of like the sort of barrenness. And so one of the things that Barry doesn't see is that he's living in a kind of Great Gatsby. One of the ways I was sort of thinking about this book was thinking about The Great Gatsby and remembering that Daisy and Tom have a kid and what terrible parents they are. And also that experience for that child, like all of a sudden mom's gone for weeks. And so I started to think about what if The Great Gatsby was narrated not from Nick Carraway, but from the child of Daisy and Tom, and what that looks like. And that's sort of what I was trying to do in this book, is sort of have a kid of parents who are having parent problems and parents who aren't necessarily the greatest communicators in the world about what's going on in their lives. And what that experience is of just the mother disappearing for weeks. And so that's what I was really interested in, was the experience of that kid. I hated The Great Gatsby growing up. It wasn't like comic books, so I wasn't interested. But I came back to it, you know, in grad school. I had a grad school professor who loved the book. And so, like, I realized that I had to try it again. And I tried it again, and I was still grumpy about it. And so I was working construction one summer, running baseboard for a mall store in Tysons Corner, Virginia. And I downloaded the audiobook. It was Tim Robbins narrating it. And I listened to it every day for 2 weeks. And it was fascinating to me how the story opened up. And what I needed to do was learn how to listen to it and how to listen to the music of what Fitzgerald's up to. And so that's how I finally became a convert, through a sort of Stockholm syndrome, forced march listening to it again and again and again.
And how many times have you reread it or listened to it since those 2 weeks? Or did it stop then?
Oh, it didn't stop then. I've been listened to it just recently. I read it again not too long ago. And it's just such a fascinating book. And I think also at the heart of the book is a conversation about whiteness. You know, Tom is reading these books all about the decline of the white empire and getting all up in arms about it. And the fact that Gatsby's partner is using Gatsby just for his whiteness, because he can go places that Meyer Wolfsheim can't go. And so that's sort of also what I started to think about in terms of this book, was a book about whiteness and about complicity in abhorrent acts.
Okay, so I really enjoyed the part of the book when Barry is reading a book from the Quarter Price Bookshop. And he said, "High school made me feel like a remainder, some unpopular appendage, which isn't doing at all what was expected of it, now selling at a loss." Now, Barry likens those books to shelter puppies, saying he wants to rescue them all. And I was on a Zoom call with you last week, and I saw your bookcase. Is Barry the only one who wants to rescue books?
I do want to rescue books at, like, used bookstores, which I love. Like, all I want to do is hold them all close to me and smell them. And yeah.
That was my last question about books question. So I want to talk about names, because names play a big part in this book. Baruch, who wants to go by Barry, Grabach, who goes by Gary. And so one girl is named Autolie. So talk to me about the power of names. I mean, I'll get to nicknames next, but right now I want to kind of talk about given names. Is there a power in a given name?
Absolutely. So one of the things I've been long thought about is that we don't call other countries the names that those countries refer to themselves as, which I think is fascinating, that we call Germany, Germany, and that's not what its people know their own country as. And so I've always been fascinated by this idea that other people call you what's convenient for them rather than what you would like to be called. And so I wanted to play with that in this book. And so everybody kind of has a name that they wish they were called, a name that they are called, and a name that they're terrified of being called. And Barry is at the center of that. That poor kid has a bunch of names that he is not comfortable with. He doesn't necessarily love his given name, Baruch, and he doesn't love the name he's given in high school. And he just wants everybody to call him Barry, but he's just not able to do that.
So I wanted to talk to you about that derogatory nickname that the kids call Barry, and even one of the teachers uses it. You know, in the acknowledgments you write, "I was bullied in school. Even worse, I bullied other people." And I don't want to necessarily ask you about your bullying experiences, but you know, I grew up in this time frame. I entered my senior year in 1985, so everything kind of felt real to me. I grew up in this time frame when name calling, you know, despite any sticks and stones rhetoric, it still happened and it was not punished. So why do nicknames have power? Is it just an imagined power by the weak who decide what the nickname is, who establish this? You know, not all nicknames are bad, but a lot of them are. What? Okay, anyway, I'm going to stop talking and let you just answer.
Yeah, I think nicknames are names given to you by your peers, and it's the way they see you. And that's what gives them so much power, is that you're being renamed as a member of this tribe that you're in. And that is frequently not what we wish we were called at all. But that's sort of how we're known within that sort of group. And that's what makes them so powerful and so ostracizing, is because you feel that distance between yourself and what that nickname is, between how you feel and how others see you. And that is a maddening place to live, between those two names.
Okay, I'm just going to read, I'm just going to keep reading your words back to you because they're better than anything I can say. So one of your chapters begins, "Some of us are powerless, not because we're underdogs who are being kept down and shuttled to the margins. No, some of the powerless are powerless because we cannot be trusted with power. It's like the universe preemptively strips us of power since all we do is cause others pain if we had any of it. Some of us are losers and not the lovable kind. Some of us have never lit a match without looking for someone nearby to burn." Can you talk to me about this idea, about this paragraph?
Yeah. You know, it makes me think of the 1987 movie, The Fisher King, which is by Terry Gilliam, one of my favorite directors. And there's a character in it, and I can't remember her name. Oh, it's Lydia. Lydia, she talks about, you know, her life now is so sheltered and small. And she says, "I think in a previous life, I must have lived only for pleasure and only taken pleasure from other people. And I'm being punished in this life to live like this. And that's okay. If only I could remember some of that pleasure, though." And it's this idea that, that you find yourself as this person. And when you're throwing around ideas of why am I this person, this idea of the reincarnated self that was the opposite of who you are and that you're being punished for that self's misdeeds, I find fascinating. Because as a kid, you know, I was a very small kid, and I would frequently like fantasize about when I used to be a barbarian. And now I'm in this life to sort of learn humility and learn the virtues of being small. And and so that's sort of where that paragraph comes from. And that this idea that maybe I'm powerless because I shouldn't have power. Maybe I'm powerless because the world has decided that me with power is too dangerous. And so Barry having those thoughts, I found fascinating. I don't know. There's a lot of Barry in me and a lot of me in Barry.
I was wondering that just because of the books. But so in that Zoom conversation that I mentioned that you were in last week, you mentioned that Barry has no guidance on how to be a hero. You know, I thought there might be a glimmer of hope when one of Barry's dad's students said that he was the best teacher she had ever had, but then he abandoned her. And then I was trying to think about anybody who might show redeemable qualities in this book. And I had to reach as far as maybe the bus driver who yelled at the guy who was abusing his dog, and then maybe the grocery store man who gave Barry running tips. But we really don't have anybody, do we?
No. No, there's very few people who point to a different way to live rather than just accepting what you've been dealt. Maybe, you know, Mr. Singh is heroic to me. You know, he finds a love and he pursues her and tries to find her and risks everything to be with her. I find him fairly heroic, but nobody in Barry's inner circle sort of show off that heroism that could have come in handy for him.
I kind of sort of like that. it's sick, isn't it? Oh man, this book was way too smart for me. Okay, so the book is set primarily in the mid-80s, and at one point, Barry is watching a lot of movies through his VCR. And he said, quote, "I think this will be the last generation raised on screens. We'll hit a tipping point and people will turn away from the TV screen and actually talk to the person in the room." There were so many laugh out loud moments for me when I was reading this, and I'm just wondering, like, were you smugly smiling as you were writing things like that?
I could see that as a very real statement coming from Barry, that like it seemed so absurd to be allowed this much access to the world's entertainment through his VCR that he just figured we had reached saturation point, which we of course know. Whew, we were nowhere near saturation point. Now we think of those as good old days.
I know.
But yeah, the screens. Oof. Oh, the screens.
Okay, now sadly I'm going from smiling to saying, okay, now I want to get back to the hate in the title. The Islamophobia, the homophobia, and the racism. We have a lot of hatred in our world. And, you know, I'd like to think that we have evolved, but does it seem that once society becomes accepting of one group, that we just move on to the next vulnerable group?
Absolutely. I mean, I came of age of the time during the Polak jokes, which were everywhere. They were in these joke books you could get through the Scholastic Book Fair. So these were like school ordained books of Polish jokes and just mocking the Polish again and again. And I also think about, you know, I frequently think about this pendulum that swung from the hatred people felt towards gay people in the mid-80s to late 80s, and then it felt like it shifted to Islam. That like we had hated the gays enough, but now we're in a war with Iraq, and so now we hated Islam. And it was fascinating because it, to me, it's sort of said that we just have this free-flowing hate that sort of hangs above us like a rain cloud, and that we just wait for the society to give us the green light on who it's okay to go after. And that's what's really scary to me. And a lot of that happens through jokes. And I also think jokes are there to keep us from feeling things. I think a lot of the hatred of gays in the 80s stemmed from the fact that they were such an imperiled community in the 80s. They were dying. And I think people were threatened with feeling empathy for them. And so they staunched up that empathy with jokes. And so it's like when you're in danger of feeling something for someone, to staunch that with jokes real fast. And this is a country who loves an underdog story. And so when we were fighting in Iraq during the first Gulf War, how could we not side with the Iraqis? They were the scrappy underdog team. But instead, again, we staunched it with jokes and sort of made ourselves feel better to this real pain and destruction we were causing.
Well, you know, the jokes, they made me squirm.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just the homophobia jokes. It was, you know, the Challenger disaster. That was just awful. Yet I remember some of those jokes growing up.
Yeah. Ugh. Yep. The Challenger is when I remember starting to feel uncomfortable with jokes. Like I was around sixth grade when that happened. And I remember that flood of jokes that came. And, you know, I was the kid who ordered joke books from the book fair. So, like, I was collecting these jokes. But they also made me feel weird.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of where I started this lifelong obsession with these kind of jokes and collecting them, because they're so odd. And again, it's like we looked in the face of that tragedy, of the Challenger tragedy, and again, we were threatened with feeling something big. And again, we just cauterized it with jokes as quickly as we could, so the pain wouldn't overwhelm us. And that's one of the services jokes do, I guess.
That was David Stuart McLean, author of the novel How I Learned to Hate in Ohio, which was published by the Overlook Press. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.